So I brought in some squash. Could anybody use an acorn squash? Anybody? Anne, could you pass this back to Anne? And Matt, here's one for you. How about one of these? Anybody? Okay. Could you pass that back, please? Could you pass that back and somebody will take it? Got this one here, Tim? No? Okay. So does anybody have, like, a really big family? Or cook for a lot of people? This is kind of the grand prize. All right, Jason. There you go. There you go. Yeah. Yeah. So that was to kind of make the point that fall is here. It's really starting to feel like fall. It didn't start out that way. I think the first official day of fall, it was over 90 degrees, and it was really hot. But now it's cooling off nicely, and the squash is in, and the potatoes and the tomatoes are in. We always get produce from one of Kathy's sisters from up north every year, and that's a sure sign of fall. So I was down at Hokyoji last weekend for the tail end of the five-day retreat. And being out in the country, it was real easy to see how things are kind of transitioning into fall. You know, the corn is more amber and less green, and the grasshoppers are out. And after a rain, you get that lovely smell of rot coming from the forest floor. All summer long, the vegetation has been burgeoning, and now it's beginning to die. And pretty soon, the world will just be one big compost pile. And I don't know if it's a sign of fall, but the coyotes were howling down there more than I've ever heard before. One morning, about 5:30 a.m., a whole pack started off on one hill, and they were answered by a pack on another hill across the valley, and then I think a third pack. Is this unusual, Susan?
Yeah,
okay. It was pretty cool. And there's still a lot of green everywhere, obviously. I see green out of all of these windows, and it seems like we're hanging on to summer quite a bit. But there's a little fall color at Hokyoji up on the ridges, and when I drove up the Mississippi River and back, there was a lot of color there. A lot of the maples are turning, and the sumac by the roadsides has started to turn red. There's a cottonwood tree in our neighbor's yard, and if there's any breeze at all, I hear the leaves blowing as I'm sitting out there in meditation on the upper deck where I sit. And I was meditating yesterday, and I realized that that sound has changed. That in the summer, the sound of the cottonwood trees, it's not exactly a lush sound, but it's kind of a fuller sound. And now it's turned a little more into a rattle. And soon those leaves are going to turn a very pale color, and they're going to fall. And, of course, there's nothing that epitomizes fall like a turning leaf. And I could have brought in a leaf. I could have brought in a bunch of leaves instead of a squash. And I almost did last year. Last year when fall came to me, it occurred to me that I wanted to do a Dharma talk that was just one leaf. And I thought about this quite a lot. I didn't want to talk about the leaf because I get so tired of talking about the Dharma. Because the Dharma is not what you say about the Dharma. The Dharma just is. And even saying the Dharma just is does it an injustice. So I didn't want the talk to be about the leaf. I wanted the talk to be the leaf. I didn't even want to hold the leaf up, because if you hold the leaf up and you draw attention to it, it's like you're saying this is kind of a separate thing from everything else. And in holding it up, there's this element of guidance, like I'm the teacher and I'm showing you something and you're the student. And there's something about teaching that is not quite the same as just being. And so singling something out, this is like what Ben was talking about a week or two ago when he was doing this, and he was talking about viewing the world through like a little telescope or a little tube. And we all do this because we just can't help it. And we see one person, like I see Raymond here, and I think, oh, that's the universe, that's everybody. But, of course, any view we choose is going to be incomplete, and therefore it's going to be inaccurate, any view. But the good news is we don't have to choose a view. We can undo our lifelong habits, and we can get rid of our viewing tube, and, oh my, here it comes, everything. Wow. So just be it. No comment. Not even this comment, just silent. Not using the viewing tube, not holding the leaf up, not separating the leaf from other things, letting all things be in the leaf, and letting the leaf be in all things. And not even making a conscious effort to look at the leaf while giving the talk. This is how I imagine it. Letting the leaf present itself, if it wishes. Not choosing where our eyes will fall. And this is a phrase that came to me at Hokyoji when I was on a walk. Stop being selective about where your eyes fall. Allow things to be revealed to you. But as it turns out, I'm not doing that leaf talk. It's impossible, really, to just let the leaf be the talk. I don't know exactly how that would work. I guess I just wouldn't show up and I'd leave the leaf on the tree. And there are other reasons for not doing the talk. Probably somebody would say, oh, you just didn't want to give a Dharma talk. And another reason is that it's been done before. And I'm referring, of course, to one of the most well-known Zen stories. And it's one I've talked about it before, only instead of a leaf, it was a flower. And that's captured in case 6 in the Gateless Barrier, called The World-Honored One Twirls a Flower. And the first paragraph of that case is, once in ancient times, when the world honored one, that's the Buddha, was at Mount, it's hard to pronounce a word that begins with the letters G-R-D-H-R. Once in ancient times, when the world honored one was at Mount Gridhrakuta, he twirled a flower before his assembled disciples. All were silent. Only Mahakashapa broke into a smile. So the assembly has shown up to hear the Buddha speak, and he doesn't say a word. He holds up a flower, and he twirls it a little bit. And we can surmise that he did this so that instead of talking about direct experience, he's manifesting direct experience. And that in Zen is something we talk about over and over. Direct experience right here, right now. This is it. This, just this. If you have ideas of enlightenment, I'm sorry, because those ideas are preventing you from seeing what it is, just this, right now. So Mahakashapa, who was Buddha's follower, who would become his successor, got it, and he simply smiled. And this is the essence of Zen. Flower, smile, or maybe not flower, not smile. All the world in the flower, and the flower in all the world. No separation. And this story of the Buddha holding up the flower is said to be the beginning of Zen. But according to the translator of the Gateless Barrier, this story was probably made up 1,500 years after the Buddha. That's when it first appeared. So the beginning of Zen is apocryphal, but that's okay. And this story is about many things. There are many possible interpretations. For some, it's about transmission, that the Buddha was transmitting something to Mahakashapa that was outside of word-based teaching. And that's okay, but I don't talk about transmission very much because nothing can really be transmitted. A teacher may have seen the magic and can guide the student a little towards seeing the magic, but the teacher can't give the magic to the student. It's also about Wayan Buddhism, no separation. Anything exists only as a part of all other things, which are all connected to each other and all contained in each other. So, stop making what is not a thing into a thing. Don't even make the Buddha's teaching into a thing. That's why Wu Men, in his comments, seems to just excoriate the Buddha. He says, "Gold-faced Gautama insolently degrades noble people to commoners. He sells dog flesh under the sign of mutton and thinks it is quite commendable." Ooh, that's tough. That's pretty tough on the Buddha. But there's a message here. Robert Aitken, who's the translator, talks about this story and says that the way of the Buddha is simply this. Nothing has any substance of its own. All things depend upon each other. Everything is completely its own reason. Nothing has any substance of its own. All things depend upon each other. Everything is completely its own reason. And I think all of Zen could be said to be contained in that simple gesture of holding up the flower. And it would be so nice not to talk. When I talk, I always get it wrong. I can't help but get it wrong. Every time I say it's not about this or it's not about that, I've made up a new rule. And then I have to say, well, it's not about that either. It's not about what I just said. And then I have to say, you know, actually, it is about that. The ego coming in and making it into a thing, that's just being. That's part of all things that depend upon another. You can't exclude ego. You can't exclude talking about the Dharma. Talking about the Dharma is the Dharma. And that's the opposite of what I said before. Yeah. And both are true. You just can't get it right with talking. But we do have Dharma talks, and here we are. This divided up world is a beautiful world. And it's an especially beautiful world if we can enjoy its dividedness with a full understanding that there is no division. If we can experience all things together and all things separate at the same time. Situations with a lot of contrast help us with that. Stark forms and stark emptiness, seeing these two things at the same time. The rigidity of our practice forms existing simultaneously with great freedom of mind. The undifferentiated nature of sweeping the path in a kind of samadhi and the puck of a pebble striking a piece of bamboo. Being and not being. Holy cow. So I am going to continue to talk here, and I'm going to talk some more about fall. And yes, I'm separating out one season of the year. But maybe I can talk about it in such a way that it's not separate and that all things are present in it. I will try. I will undoubtedly fail. And somehow failure will be success, because it can't be any other way. The only way you can mess it up is to want it to be different from what it is. That's another phrase that came to me at Hokyoji. I thought, I have this afternoon ahead of me on the Zafu. The only way I can possibly mess this up is if I want it to be different from what it is. If I can let it be what it is, it can't possibly go wrong. So before I went down to Hokyoji, I was driving my usual route from work to Zen Center, and I was sitting at a stoplight, and to my left, you know, just outside of my window, was a median, a concrete median, and on it was this little cluster of plants, which a lot of people would call weeds, growing out of a little crack there. And there was one part that was almost perfect, kind of a flattened green globe, and then it had two large green sprigs growing out of it, kind of like rabbit ear antennae, and one of them had tiny white flowers on it. And it was so beautiful that I took a picture of it leaning out my window, and I put it on Facebook, and I said, this somehow gives me hope. And it happened that about 10 days later, after I had gone to Hokyoji, I was in the same spot, and I happened to look down, and oh my, that little green globe was now completely brown, and it was very kind of rough looking. And the one sprig was still green, but it had these big white flowers. It looked heavy with white flowers. And the other sprig was just kind of there. It was just a sprig. And I realized, this is three different plants. I thought maybe it was one strange plant, but it's three separate ones. And I took another picture. And so what I saw there was growing and flowering and also dying simultaneously. The globe turns from green to brown, and it's dying, as one sprig comes to full flower, and it's still growing. And the other sprig, well, we don't know. It seems to be in stasis. There's some potentiality there. So that's the kind of thing I find exciting, weeds growing in the median. And fall is like this little clump of weeds. Things begin to die at the same time that things are coming into the greatest fullness of their being. We have the full expression of the tomato plant, which is the tomato itself, happening at the same time that the vine is beginning to die. And in fall, we have the chrysanthemums just beginning to be what they are, and we have the spinach and the thyme, which is still edible, at the same time that other things are stone dead, maybe long dead, maybe decomposed already. But in the deadness and the decomposition, we can see spring in that. We can see the coming spring. It's spring now, it's winter now, it's fall now. All things are coming, and all things are going away all the time. All is process, and snapshots cannot capture it. We are process. It's an illusion to think that we are a certain thing at a certain time. There's no snapshot, there's no tube, there's no me, and there's no you. Again, anything exists only as a part of all other things, which are connected to each other and contained in each other. So, having said all this, having clearly established that there is no fall as a separate thing, I think I can safely talk about the glories of fall. What we've heard up to this point is the world's longest disclaimer. And maybe I can get away with saying that fall is my favorite season, and you'll get that there's some irony in that statement. How can you have a favorite when nothing exists? But a lot of people say that fall is their favorite season. A lot of people. And why is this? I've been thinking about this for a long time because it's always been my favorite season. And one thing may be the idea of new beginnings. And that's maybe because school starts in fall. It's exciting for little kids. It's exciting for their parents because they get a little time to themselves now if they're stay-at-home parents. It's exciting for people going off to college for the first time. I used to take off hitchhiking in the fall. It just seemed like the right thing to do. And we kind of gear up here at Zen Center. We've got classes, morning study group, fall practice period, initiation. Sometimes we have ordinations in the fall. And also there's this aspect of preparation for things in the fall. You bring in the harvest, you bring in the wood, you take the air conditioner out pretty soon. You drain the gas out of the lawnmower. You get things all buttoned up. And you have a finite time to do this. And it feels good. There's also the fact that it's getting colder and the days are getting shorter. And you're in that in-between place where it's a little cold, but it feels good. It feels good to put on that jacket. It feels good to build a fire outside if you can do that. It feels good to sleep with the windows open with a lot of blankets. The cold is just close enough that it's exciting, but it's not debilitating. Things are just beginning to go away, but you know you're going to be able to hold on to them for a little while yet. And so they're really precious. So I want to tell you about this thing that happened in the Black Hills in South Dakota. If you've heard this before, please forgive me. In 1980, I was out in the Black Hills for something called the Black Hills International Survival Gathering, put on by the Black Hills Alliance. And I was out there for 2 months working on this gathering as a volunteer. And it was about stopping uranium mining and other kinds of exploitation in the Black Hills, and it was about Native American treaty rights. And I was out there with a lot of great friends, and I had been preparing to do this thing for maybe a year, maybe 2 years. And we were engaged in this wonderful cause together. And there was a lot of love and a lot of firmness because of the nature of the task. And really, it was one of the best times of my life, if I may again express a preference. And there were about 4,000 people out there for 10 days, and it was a community. And there was a stage set up every night, and there would be music. There were big stars out there. We had Jackson Browne, Bonnie Raitt, Larry Gatlin, people like that. And it was July, but July can be surprisingly cold in the Black Hills. And one night, Floyd Westerman was playing on stage. Maybe some of you remember Floyd Westerman. He started calling himself Floyd Red Crow Westerman when he began to appear in movies. He was Sisseton, Dakota. He's been gone about 10 years now. And he sounded a lot like Johnny Cash when he sang. And everyone really loved him. He had the wisdom of a lot of years and a lot of experience. And one night he just said the simplest thing in his really deep, wonderful voice that I'll never forget. We were out there in the dark because there was just a little light on the stage. And he said between a couple of songs, he remarked how cold it was, and he said, "There's something about a cold night that makes you hungry for life." Hungry for life. And I thought, yeah, he's got it. Hungry for life. Maybe that's about desire, and maybe not. Maybe that's just about fully being. Fully being. When winter's not here yet, but you know it's coming, and you can be warm in your jacket, and warm by your fire, you can tempt winter a little bit, and you can let yourself get pretty cold, and you can say, "Yeah, come get me." And you feel the excitement of it. It's like the edge between life and death. It's the presence of all those contrasting things. It's the burgeoning fruit happening at the same time the vine is dying. The coming of winter throws things into relief. In the artistic sense, that sculptural technique where you cut some things away so other things come forward. These things have been separated out, so some of the things we can see clearly, and somehow separation helps us to see non-separation. When something is going away, you see how precious it is and you value it more. And fall throws things into relief. As the leaves fall, you see the outlines of the trees, which you couldn't see before. You see the landscape under the forest, which you could not see before. You go out into your garden, and instead of this multitude of sights and beautiful and bizarre things all running together, you see mostly dirt, and you see some dying vegetation that might be a little green, a little bit black, and you see a few bright bits of color. Maybe some red rotting tomatoes, some green squash, some bright pumpkins, maybe a brightly colored caterpillar, and maybe that blue, blue October sky above it all. And there are just a few things to appreciate, and they stand out. And fall is the coming of silence and simplicity after the excess and fullness of late summer. And this reminds me of the retreat experience. You cover up the bulletin boards, you eliminate talking, you eliminate social signals, you face the wall, and you've eliminated everything except your own presence with your own heart mind. Things are culled out, things are thrown into relief, and somehow seeing a few things vividly helps us to see that there are no things at all. And I have a lot of good memories of fall, as you no doubt do as well. There was one fall when I was building the grain elevators, when I was staying in a place in eastern Iowa called Olin on the Wapsipinicon River, near Stone City where Grant Wood lived. It's a beautiful landscape, these little kind of bumpy hills. And I was there with my brother Jim and this other guy named John Becker, who was kind of like our honorary brother. We knew him really well. And we all three lived on the job site in campers. And all day we would work on that elevator under that beautiful blue October sky. And at lunch we'd go into Olin for this massive feed at Mackey's Cafe, and they had all these tomatoes. I just remember the tomatoes in particular, and all of this other produce. And then we'd go back to the job site and climb a ladder 120 feet up after having eaten this enormous meal. It was not so easy. And we'd work up there, and so we had this really beautiful view of the town and the river. And after work, we'd build a fire, and we'd sit outside, and we'd take a long time cooking dinner as darkness fell. And we knew and valued silence. And the cold would come in, and we'd draw a little closer to the fire, and it was just a really good life for as long as it lasted. But, of course, it didn't last because the job ended and winter came and the three of us scattered. I think John went to Texas and Jim went and worked somewhere and I went somewhere else. And I was kind of on my own then. And when winter came, or maybe it was the next winter, I can't remember for sure, I was working on a feed mill in Manson, Iowa, and I was living with some guys from the job site who had found this farmhouse to winter in near Otho, down by Fort Dodge. And there was a group of us there, and it was kind of fun, but then everybody left except this one guy and me, this guy named Badger, and he was an old construction guy. Come to think of it, actually, he was probably younger than I am now. But at the time, he seemed like this really old guy. And in the evenings, he'd watch TV, and I would type on my typewriter because I was writing. And we didn't interact very much. And he was really tough, and he was really cheap. And he didn't expect a lot of comfort out of life. And he didn't want to spend money for fuel oil. And he said, "We're going to keep it at 50 degrees. And I said, okay. And he said, because I didn't want to be the weak one in the house, he said, "It'll be fine. Just use a lot of blankets." So we kept it at 50. And all day long, I would work outside, often on the top of this feed mill. This was in January, and the wind would be blowing. And at night, I'd come home to this 50-degree house. And I felt like I really never got warm that entire winter. Sometimes I was a little less cold, sometimes I was a little more cold, but I was always cold. The only time I ever got adequate heat was in my truck, driving from home to work and work to home, and in the dark both ways. And that was the best part of my day, and it wasn't that great. And for years after that, I avoided the cold. I just couldn't stand to be cold. I think I'm okay now, but it took years. And to add to it, there is this road between Otho and Manson, which is the most boring, undifferentiated stretch of road in the United States, I think. It's about 15 miles of flat, straight road, perfectly even pavement, telephone poles perfectly spaced, and gravel roads intersecting exactly every 1 mile. And I drove that every day. And that was the best part of my day. But the funny thing about it is, I like remembering this, and I like telling the story. And there's a certain pride in it, and I think it was good for me. And sometimes you just got to work. Sometimes you just got to endure stuff. It was so stark and lonely that there was a kind of a strange beauty to the whole thing, even to the longing and the dissatisfaction. There was a strange beauty to the deprivation of it. And sometimes deprivation and fulfillment aren't all that different. Winter was there during the fall around that fire. And fall was there in the winter in that cold, cold house. And there's a beauty in things going away. There's a beauty to the coming of winter. Those leaves dry up completely. They get batted around on hard snow drifts by those cold winter winds sweeping over the prairie. Warmth goes away and it gets positively dangerous out there. And it is stark. And there is a beauty not only in things going away, but also in the absence of things. Death comes. Form is emptiness, and emptiness form. Winter follows inexorably from fall, and inexorably from winter comes spring. It's not really death that happens. It's a rearrangement. That's all. And the part of you that sees that, that it's not an ending, but a rearrangement, cannot suffer. And all of this applies, of course, to getting old. As I am, just a little bit. I feel like it's just kind of starting. Now and then I'll look around a room and realize I'm the oldest person there. And I'm not as limber as I used to be. Sometimes I'm the last one to get up from my zafu. And I can't just hop up in the bed of my pickup truck the way I used to. It's a bit of a project now. I have to plan it out. Okay, I'm going to put my foot there, and I'm going to hold on here. Here I go. But I'm doing fine, and actually, it is fascinating. It is fascinating. It's a time of diminishing capacity in some ways, in terms of physicality and energy. But at the same time, it's a time of gathering strength, where things just keep getting better. I know more than I ever knew before, and I'm sure about what to do with my life, and pretty much sure about how to do it. I'm more focused. So there is a beauty in these contrasting things. And when the time comes when there is nothing but cold clarity, I know that there will be beauty in that as well. Beauty in the absence of things, reconciled with beauty in the presence of things. Summer is followed by fall. Fall is followed by winter. Winter is followed by spring. And nothing ends. It's just a rearrangement. And there is great comfort in that, much like the comfort of a warm jacket on a cold morning. And that's my talk. Thank you for listening. And if anyone has something to say, that would be great. But you can't give the squash back. Mark.
I was just thinking about cool fall days and I have a shop with a smile. I have a school bus stop outside my window, and every morning really young school-age kids wait for their parents for the school bus. And on one of those really first, really beautiful, crisp fall days, I had my window open, and it was still kind of gray outside in the window. The crisp air was coming in, and the kids were getting on the bus, and I heard one parent say to their kid, "Now don't forget to smile."
Good, good. Yeah. Well, let's just sit for a minute and see if anything else comes up. Yes.
I had a question. I was intrigued by your story of the winter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what an influence it had on you at some level. I was just wondering if you could go back and somehow change that. Have an electric blanket. Would the experience itself so transformative that you would stick, still be cold?
That's a good question. If I could go back, would I change it? Would I change the conditions of that really stark winter? And I would like to think, no, I wouldn't. Because It was what it was. It brought me to where I am. Who can say whether it was really a good thing or a bad thing? You know, it kind of lacked those momentary pleasures. But, you know, and it's good to have some hardship, too. If we always have ease, then we're going to expect ease. I do know I can endure cold. And I do know that I can stick to a task for a few months, even if it's very unpleasant. So, no, I tend to have few regrets. I mean, if I acted unskillfully and I hurt someone, you know, I certainly would do that over. But I don't tend to regret the various experiences I've had. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for that question. Anything else? Yes, Tanya.
I wanted to share, I thought I had a question early on, and then I kind of answered it.
Uh-huh.
To share what that was, and maybe you can redirect it. So on my way here, I had the news on, and I was kind of contemplating how we struggle today with the different viewpoints in the media and how we have become very divisive in terms of, well, media is always left wing, or the media is always right wing. So anyway, I was kind of contemplating that on the way here. And then right away you mentioned the viewpoint thing. And I thought the question was going to be, well, how do we address this divisiveness of our media? And the answer that started coming to me was, especially when you said the Dharma is the talk. It kind of dawned on me that what we need to strive for is more listening to the other viewpoint. This is so important that we have these different viewpoints and these different dialogues. And it's kind of just dawning on me that in practicing our Buddhism, it is important to continue listening to the other viewpoints, even if we don't agree with
it. I think so. I think that's a very good point, and I don't know if I need to add anything to that. But yeah, yeah. Great. Thank you. Yes, Randy.
Ted, you always enjoy your talks. They're so poetic, and you're a great storyteller. And I remember one of the stories about building these great elevators. Remember Dharma talk about baseball. So I'm wondering, with the game coming up tomorrow between your favorite team, the Yankees, and the Minnesota Twins, right? It's coming up on Tuesday.
Tuesday, yeah.
Any comments on
that? Well, thank you so much for bringing up that I'm a Yankee fan in the middle of Minneapolis. All right, there's another one. The question was whether I have any thoughts about that. Boy, I almost want the Twins to win, you know, because of the history between these two teams. And the Twins are a really feisty team, and the Yankees are such a powerful team. And I'm sorry I'm a Yankee fan, okay? When I was 7 years old, Mantle and Maris were vying for, you know, the home run crown, and Maris got 61, Mantle got 54, and I was really impressed, and they became my favorite team, and I'm a loyal person, and they've been my team the whole time. And my mom, bless her heart, was one of the most tolerant people I ever knew, but she could not forgive me for being a Yankee fan. So I really love the Yankees. I'm really excited about Aaron Judge. He's a rookie. He's got 52 home runs. He was putting up triple crown numbers early in the season. And then he won the home run derby, and he just went into this slump. I think that home run derby just did him in. So this doesn't really have anything to do with Zen, does it? I hope it's a really good game, and if the Twins win, I will be okay with them, because I love the Twins too. Thanks. Yes, Charlie.
Yeah, when you started your talk, you talked about the leaves, the different sounds in the leaves, and you mentioned turn from one sound to a rattling. When you said rattling, just brought back to me the end of life, death rattle.
The death rattle.
And I don't know how many people have heard that, but it's, you know the end is near when you hear the death rattle.
Yeah, it's a real thing, and it kind of fits in with the end of things and things going from a lushness to a dryness and a rattling. Yeah, yeah. Ooh, Susan.
I was thinking this is probably a whole different talk about the parallels between the sort of deprivation we experience in Zen practice that we choose when we do sesshin or retreat, and what you learned about deprivation and starkness, and you know, it's probably very obvious, but I just wanted to say that we're privileged to choose it.
Mm-hmm.
We choose that for what we can learn from it, and but you know, obviously there's people who are experiencing it not their choice over long periods, and you knew that your experience was going to have an end point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, you know, even though it's obvious, I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah.
And you know, it's in all the traditions, there's an element of to go deep, you know, to be in depth, to have that experience of deprivation, darkness. And when I heard rattle, I thought about the shaman, the shamans and the rattles.
Mm-hmm.
And someone at Hokkyoji told me there were insects that sounded to her at one point after sitting for a couple days, like a shamanic rattle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, and that's a wonderful point about how we are privileged to be able to choose this. Thank you. Yes?
Professional sports can be used as an analogy for the transitory nature of being.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And that's what I was trying to get at.